Resilient Cyber Podcast brings you conversations from diverse cybersecurity professionals, ranging from executives, subject matter experts, and aspiring entrants. Today's diverse threat landscape requires systems that can withstand a variety of cyber incidents, remaining trustworthy and secure.
Resilient Cyber is sponsored by Acquia, a digital services, service-disabled, veteran-owned small business that is passionate about enabling innovation and driving secure digital transformation. Acquia believes in guardrails over roadblocks and security as a business enabler. Learn more at acquia.us. That's A-Q-U-I-A.us. We want to take a moment to give a shout-out to our Season 6 sponsor, Push Security. If you're in a cloud-first business, you already know identities are the new security perimeter. Identity-based attacks are now the most common form of cyber attack, making up around half of all data breaches. Push Security gives your security team visibility of your whole internet-facing identity attack surface and automatically hardens it against identity-based attacks. So if identity security is a priority for you in 2024, check out Push Security at pushsecurity.com. I want to take a moment to give another shout-out to one of our Season 6 sponsors, Checkmarks. Checkmarks is a global leader in application security with a consolidated platform appreciated by enterprises across the globe. In fact, 60% of Fortune 100 companies use Checkmarks to boost their security from code to cloud and trim down total cost of ownership. That means securing billions of lines of code every year, enabling almost 20,000 scans an hour, and helping to plug over 2 million vulnerabilities. If you don't already, try to read their groundbreaking research and monthly trends reports. They've helped change my understanding of application security and software supply chain security, and I suspect they will for you too. Thank you for joining the Resilient Cyber Show. My name is Chris Hughes, and today I'm joined by Erez Jalan. Erez, thanks for being here.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me here.
Absolutely. I've been following your profile on LinkedIn and some of the research you all have been putting out and stuff. But for folks that don't know you, don't know what you're up to, can you tell us a bit about your background?
Sure. So I guess the beginning of the background is relatively similar to other people in the cybersecurity field. As a boy, I built my own stuff, managed to break my own stuff, learned alone, did security before it was even considered security. As far as I was concerned, I was doing computer stuff. Later, I learned development, but in the academia, I actually went to other directions around biology and veterinary medicine. But then I came back to my to the areas that I really love and passionate about, started as a developer until I realized I can break better than build. And then from there, I grew to become what I am now, the VP of Security Research at Checkmarks, because apparently I'm better at managing than breaking. So I'm moving together with my skills. In addition to that, this is what I do a day. At night, I'm also the founder of the AppSec Village at DEF CON and volunteering in several projects of OWASP, one of the founders and the co-leaders of the OWASP API security project, and also advising to several startups. But, I think I covered most of it here.
Yeah, so you got quite a bit going on. That's very cool. I didn't know you were involved with the AppSec Village stuff, so I'm going to dive into that with you here later on in the conversation too. I know some of the research and some of the things I've been seeing you sharing, via Checkmarks and on your profile and such is focused around software supply chain security. It's been a hot topic, obviously, from obviously the cybersecurity executive order, Log4j, SolarWinds, and the slew of other things that have come of that, those incidents in public. Proprietary software vendors as well as open source software. I'm curious from your perspective, being on the research side, what are some of the most interesting developments you've seen in, say, the last, 12 months or so around software supply chain security?
Okay, so software supply chain security in general, I think is the latest scope in the huge scope of application security. Application security as a traditional way of looking at security was usually, just looking at what I'm doing. And then suddenly we realized that, wait, most of my code is not even mine and the processes are not something that I started. And I think we are seeing a very, very quick increase, a around that in the last, say, 12 months, but probably a bit more. We see a big rise in malicious packages being introduced into the ecosystem. There are many attacks to open source packages. The repositories like NPM and others. Sometimes we see old methods like, you know, typo squatting, which is something that is not new, or new methods specifically for the open source package ecosystem, like starjacking or repojacking. And in parallel, we see attackers actually feeling more and more comfortable in these areas. We see them invade into more areas under this umbrella term of software supply chain. The popularity of these attacks really grow. We see junior pen testers using these things, these attacks, and we're seeing state actors using these attacks, some for very, very broad and catch-all attacks. And some of them are very sophisticated, very narrow, aimed at a specific vector or even a specific target. And to top it all, since we're talking about the last year, you know, you cannot talk about a challenge these days without talking about models, AI, LLMs, generative AI in general. Suddenly we realize that this is going to be a big chunk of what we consider supply chain in software. And these are the biggest, I think, developments or where our attention as a research group is.
Yeah, I think you're spot on in terms of both it being a subset of the broader kind of application security and also now AI being part of the conversation of whether we're talking about attacks against, you know, proprietary large AI service providers or platforms, as well as like open source, you know, models and things like that are going to be used by the community. We're seeing a lot of that happening as well. And as you point out, you know, we have seen a lot of different types of attacks, and we've seen, you know, guidance come out from, you know, vendors like yourself on check marks, as well as like, you know, NSA, U.S. government, international governments around the world, efforts by OpenSSF and others. You know, how do you think we're doing in terms of addressing the software supply chain threats? Do you feel like we're making some progress, or do you think that, you know, we're struggling to keep pace with the adversaries on this front, given it's such a vast attack surface with so many different types of techniques that they can use?
Yeah, so I think both. I think we are making progress, but I think we are still struggling to catch up. As you said, you know, there is increased focus on open source security and on software supply chain security in general. I think that the industry really understands now the risk of relying on these areas. Some of it is because of the attacks that you mentioned, SolarWinds, Log4j, and others. Some of it is because of guidance that came from CISA and NSA, Biden's executive order. I think that it all culminated into creating new practices of managing open source software. It gave a lot of pressure to adopt SBOM in general, or to, even if not SBOM, to have better transparency to what you have, what you use, and the security that comes with it, or lack of security that comes with it. And I think that what is interesting for me as a person who is more sometimes looking at the community side of things, like, you know, open source projects and OWASP and the AppSec Village, I think we are finally starting to adopt some sort of ecosystem approach to security. It's no longer, this is mine, this is yours, you need to protect this. If I use this and something happens, you're in fault. This is something that we are slowly seeing in the jargon, in people less blaming, you know, open source maintainers. And this is, I think, the biggest headway that we're having, you know, moving forward as an ecosystem. As you said, we are behind. It will take more effort, more time, and more attention. And if you want to dig a bit more about my opinions about SBOM, feel free, but SBOM is just the first step.
Yeah, I'm actually going to do that. I actually spoke last week at CISA's SBOM-O-Rama, the winter event last, what was it? last Thursday, I want to say. Yeah. What are your thoughts on SBOM? Obviously, we've seen a lot of traction around, pushing for the use of SBOM to drive transparency. We have, the Cyclone DX, SPDX, led by OWASP and Linux Foundation and so on. In your role as a researcher and a practitioner, how are you seeing people use SBOMs, or is there a reluctance to adopt these artifacts? What are your thoughts around SBOM in terms of utility of, mitigating attacks, or at least providing better transparency and so on?
Okay, so as I mentioned, I think this is a must. This is not something we can skip. This is something we must have as the first step of transparency into what we have. It's not even transparency outside. It's transparency to understand what I have in my software, in this solution that I create. The problem starts when the SBOM is the goal. Is basically when I believe that I need an SBOM for the sake of having an SBOM. Okay, if I have an SBOM and I'm going to put it on my shelf, it will going to have very little effect on my security stats. The SBOM is the first step. It's crucial and it's necessary, but this is the first step. Then you need to understand, what do I do with it? How do I actually act upon it? What does it mean if this parameter or that parameter are different? How do I translate it into risk, and how do I translate the risk into the business? Because this is eventually the reason for that. So when I ask people if they know what software supply chain is, this is, by the way, a good thing that happened in the last 12 months as well. I hear more yes than no. Not all of it is accurate, but this is a different conversation. But when I hear a yes, and then I ask them, so what do you do with it? And they say, oh, we have an SBOM. Then I pause and I wait for, and we do that with it. So this is still lacking. I think that SBOM, we need to remember it's the tool and not the goal. Also, we need to remember that it causes some sort of over-reliance or sometimes a false sense of security, and I'll explain. I think that SBOM is not enough these days. We see that SBOM is like a good friend from Jack Marks gave this example, and I'm using it a lot now. It's like a list of ingredients. Okay, so you can look at your snack or your bread and see that you have in the bread flour, salt, and water. Okay, this is your ingredients. Seems okay, right? You have no problem using that, and then you eat the bread, and then you get a stomach ache. What you're missing is the fact that the factory was dirty, the person who kneaded the dough does not wash their hands, etc. So basically the SBOM tells you, dude, everything is fine, go for it. Take a piece of bread, take this package, take this software. But we are missing the processes. And if I look at it in the software way, then, okay, I'm using SCA and SAST, so I know that my code has no vulnerabilities. I know that I wrote no vulnerabilities and introduced nothing. I'm even using, check marks, a threat API to make sure that I have no malware in my packages. But then maybe I'm using a Jenkins that is malicious. Maybe I have a build command or a hook somewhere that is malicious or vulnerable. And then everything becomes tainted. So this is what I'm saying about, yes, SBOM is necessary. SBOM is good. Let's adopt SBOM. Let's not over-rely on it. Or let's go to the next level. Let's create the complete SBOM. This is an idea we're playing with, to create a C SBOM, like a complete SBOM, to have not only assets but processes. Maybe one day, who knows?
Yeah, no, I really like your take there. And that was kind of part of the conversation last week at the CISA event was, it's kind of, SBOM has overtaken the conversation a bit in software supply chain security, where it's become the end all be all, when really it's just one tool in a toolbox of things we could be using to mitigate risk around software supply chain security. And I like where you're going with, thinking about the broader process. That's where we're getting to things like attestations around, build environments and what was done by whom, under what circumstances, on what system, and so on. All that's relevant too, in addition to just the end artifact of an SBOM. So I really like where you went with that. And since you brought up open source security, I wanted to ask you as well, you know, it's one thing to have, you know, third-party risk management and you know, cybersecurity, supply chain risk management around your vendors and products and so on. But what are your thoughts around, you know, the open source software ecosystem? We've seen a lot of, like you said, malicious packages and things occurring in that space. And sometimes there are CVEs, but those are kind of lagging indicators of risk. You know, there's a vulnerability at that point. What do you think about, you know, leading indicators of risk or some things that people could be doing from a proactive perspective around, you know, securely consuming and using open source, for example?
Yeah, so this is an ever, this is getting more and more complex. I think that if 5, 6, 7 years ago I was talking about open source issues and I heard CISOs or AppSec managers saying, okay, so we won't use open source. It was funny back then and it's funny now. Obviously, this train has left the station long, long, long ago. So this is not an option anymore, right? What we need to do is, first of all, try to be a bit more self-reliant. For example, if you need a specific feature of, I don't know, pushing text to the left, maybe you don't have to download an open source library with very, very complex functionality just to push text to the left, and you can do it yourself. This is not a recommendation that developers like, and I understand that. But you know, be a bit judgmental. Maybe it's something you can do in 10 minutes, then do it. So this is kind of to try and lower the attack surface. Obviously, it's not scalable, and the really complex things are the things that we're using. Try to have them from known sources. This is where SBOM and tools that are doing SCA scans are actually helpful. But then again, there comes a moment in time where you suddenly have a CVE for your specific library, and then you need to decide, am I actually using the class or function that is vulnerable? Is it something that I'm using all the time? Is it critical? Is it something that I can easily replace? Maybe I am not well updated. Maybe I have a version like 6 versions ago, and I know that if I'm going to update it now, it's going to break everything that I have. So you need to be prepared for that. Try to be on the latest. But then again, I cannot update thousands of packages every year just because I want to be updated. So I'm currently at a point in my answer to you where every practitioner is. They know that they have a lot to do. They know what they need to do. They usually don't have the time to do that. What we're trying to do is to help them to be a bit more proactive. And this is something that you already talked about, trying to understand as soon as possible that something is wrong. Help them to understand as soon as possible how bad it is, how the risk looks like. Is there really a risk? If it's not something I'm using, yes, I want to fix it, but maybe I don't need to wake someone up at Saturday at 2 a.m., for example, which is a big difference than doing it Monday or Tuesday morning to some people. And then when we have that figured out, which is not an easy task, suddenly we have all the areas around malicious code that is crawling into our open source packages. Sometimes because, you know, good people turn evil. Sometimes it's because good people turn over the work to evil people. Sometimes it's just because you wrote a mistake and fallen into a typo squatted package. There are many reasons and many ways to fall. The thing here you must be proactive, because unlike a vulnerability, when we're talking about CVEs, when you have something malicious, if you run it once on your machine, especially if it's a machine of development that has some sort of access to production, it's basically game over. This is, you know, the equivalent of normal virus or any other malware that we know. This is running one time and that's it. These are the things you need to find before you run them, before even you are committing your code for the first time. And this is really the biggest challenge that we see around open source. You must be proactive. It's no longer scanning your code and looking for something. It's making sure that your code does not have the potential of using something that is dangerous, malicious, or anything like that. Because unlike a CVE that tells you, oh, there's a vulnerability, there is some sort of chance it will be used. No, when you have malware in your code, in the code you're running on, in your testing environment, in your development environment, whatever, this is bad. Everything stops. And this is the you know the latest problems of practitioners that we see at the moment.
Yeah, I like where you were going with that in terms of starting to get towards kind of a bit of a, like a posture management, not looking at like lagging indicators of risk like vulnerabilities or known vulnerabilities, but actually looking at proactive indicators of risk before they become a problem. But I did want to raise one question from the audience here, because I'm curious, you know, both from your perspective as a researcher, practitioner, as well as check marks, you know, we know that we're dealing with a lot of, you know, cognitive overload of vulnerabilities. There's thousands of vulnerabilities, hundreds of thousands, millions of vulnerabilities and backlogs, depending on the organization's size and complexity. And someone asked, you know, what priority metrics do you use for vulnerabilities? You know, for example, to help developers or engineers prioritize fixing, you know, we have things like known exploitation, SysAKEV, we have exploitability, probability with EPSS, for example, reachability, severity. You know, where do you see people kind of making headway in terms of efficient approaches around prioritization?
So I think that all of the above, but it must be. You know, prorated in a way. Sometimes some things are heavier, and this is a bit subjective. You need to have the context. So first and foremost, I believe that understanding how relevant this CVE is to your code, I think is necessary. What we do in our platform, since we have both SAST and SCA, we have what we call an exploitable path. Other vendors call it reachability, and the reason we call it an exploitable path is because it's very specific. This is our way to tell you, look, this is not only a CVE, a non-CVE. You are using it here, specifically here. You can see that you're using it. You should know that you should not use that. This is one thing. All the rest of the things you said, the EPSS and the KEV and all those, these are a bit more secondary to understanding the criticality of what you have. I mean, if you have, I don't know, the CVE-10 and you're looking at it and this is only on an isolated server that is showing you the menu of the cafeteria, do whatever you want, basically. If it's a CVE that is even lower, but this is for your internal IP, and then the most important thing, even if it does not have a known exploit or something like that, you probably want to get there. If you have so many things that you need to order or to filter, because of something is very critical, then yeah, you can use all those. I think all of them are good. They're good enough. They're good indications of where to start. Okay, but basically it's the criticality that wins every time, because the rest are just parameters to make it a bit higher or a bit lower. Basically, if it's critical, you need to handle that, and if you know that it's touching your code or you're activating, you're actually using in production the class or the file that is problematic, you need to take care of that.
Yeah, I like your answer there. I think as you point out, there's no replacement for business context or organizational context. That's going to be the most critical piece of it before known exploitation or probability or et cetera, things like that. You need to know what's specific to your organization, the type of data science system, the exposure of a system, the criticality of a system to your organization and operations and so on. So I think you're spot on. I wanted to ask you too, it's one thing to get ahead of things like we talked about with posture and so on, but incidents are inevitably going to happen. How do you think incident response has or should evolve, for organizations that are trying to make sense of the modern landscape of open source, cloud, SaaS, third-party providers and platforms? What do you think the future of incident response looks like in this kind of complex landscape?
That's a tough one. That's a tough one because I think that no one really has a silver bullet yet. The good news is that we're not looking for a silver bullet anymore. At least that. We're trying to improve things. Incident response was when we didn't have, you know, things like open source and all that, it was relatively easy and contained and maintained. Currently, things are all over the place. If you don't have, you know, your specific allowed repo to use libraries from, or Artifactory, or things that are allowed ahead of time, this is going to be very, very hard. Also, as I said, as an incident response person, what do? You have a CVE. Let's even say that you decided that you want to act upon it. Do you fix it and then lose track of the version? By the way, if you change a version, if you fork it and fix it, suddenly you have no CVEs anymore because this is not an original thing. So maybe why not do that? Do you actually try to update it and suffer from any breakage that can come with it? These are the things that we see. And then you add to that, suddenly the same team that is doing application security and that kind of incident response, suddenly they have the areas of malware. And this is what I mentioned before. Well, you know, a simple scan suddenly tells you, listen, you've been using a package that someone flagged as malicious. This is something you need to stop right now and do something. And this throws us into the era of malicious things in our application security. The amount of work that needs to be done in incident response right now, and you mentioned, you know, the cloud and API security and all these things that we have, sometimes we're afraid to say how little control we have over them sometimes, and we're losing our north. This moves us more to the area where we must commit to proactive understanding of what we have. And again, it brings us kind of close to the S-bomb thing, but it needs to be all around, all across. I need to understand what's going on ahead of time. I need my developers to understand the risks. This is not happening at the moment. I don't see anything beyond, you know, developers need to do the OSP top 10 every year, once a year, right? I don't see anything about around supply chain. You talk to developers sometimes and they're amazing, and you try to explain what supply chain means, and they say, listen, there was supply chain since forever, since there was supply. And then you need to tell them that, yeah, but in software it's like you're telling an airplane manufacturer usually brings the wheels from Japan, engine from the US, windows from Germany, and then they walk in the street and someone goes to them and say, look, I have an engine for you. Take it, use it in your airplanes. And then you say, okay, is it good? And then they answer, of course, it has 5,000 thumbs up or stars. And then you say, okay, I'll use it. Obviously, you know, it makes us smile, but this is the disaster that is open source security at the moment, or supply chain, or software supply chain. And as soon as developers understand that, they understand that they need to be worried before something happens. What is this package? What am I doing here? Do I need to tell someone? Do I need to talk to the security people in my team to understand if this is something that makes sense? Do we have the right tooling for that? Do we have the right scans for that? And it all comes to proactive understanding of what might happen. And you cannot plan towards what might happen if you don't know what you have, and your developers, DevOps, CloudOps, are not educated around that. This is by far the biggest thing you can do for your company.
Yeah, it's a bit ironic in a sense that, you know, software asset inventory has been like a CIS critical control for decades. And here we are now in 2023, 2024, you know, saying, hey, maybe we should know what we're using from whom and from where. And it's like, yeah, that's kind of been a thing for a long time. We just haven't been doing it when it comes to open source in particular. So I think that the malicious actors have realized that and they're taking advantage of that. And our organizations are scrambling to get that inventory in place and understand what they're using, what their suppliers are using and products that they're consuming and so on. So I think you're spot on. And then ultimately, as you put it, you know, without that inventory, you'll be ill-equipped to respond when an incident does happen because you don't know where it resides in your enterprise or what you're actually using or, you know, what systems are impacted and so on. You know, I also wanted to ask you, you know, I know Checkmarx has a bit of an AppSec platform, you know, SaaS, DaaS, secrets management, you know, infrastructure as code scanning, you have a comprehensive offering. There's been, and I'm sure you've noticed this in the last, you know, especially the last few weeks, there's been a heated debate in the industry about platformization is the term I think I heard versus, you know, point products and like which one's, you know, more superior, which way we're going to go. What's your thought on the kind of the debate between best of breed versus point products or versus platforms, I'm sorry. And do you think the two will always exist? You know, where do you fall on that kind of spectrum of the debate?
Okay, so I might be a bit biased because, you know, at Checkmarx, we decided to go around the consolidation of tools and platform. And I'll explain my thought here and what kind of led us towards this. It was not an easy or quick path. This is something that we're slowly transitioning into in the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. So we have the let's talk about the how comfortable it is. Okay, this is kind of, for me, it's the lowest reason to move to a platform, but it's comfortable. You have everything in one place. One touch of a button runs everything. You have all the, you know, you have a unified dashboard. You have everything aggregated in one place. That's nice. You have only one invoice per, I don't know, per time period. You have one vendor. When I talk to customers sometimes or to prospects and I ask them how many vendors they have to protect one piece of software or one solution, I get answers between 5 and 17. This is, I think the record was 17. This is not fun at all. It's not fun also for the AppSec teams, for the security teams. Security fatigue is a real thing, and it works even only on one report. So try to take that 10 or 15 times a month. So basically, it's just more comfortable to many teams. I think that the smart part here, or at least the platform we're building, is what we call fondly fusion. The idea is not only to have all the results in one place, but have the results speak to each other and actually explain to you what is more risky. I found this, but it's more critical than you know, because look what the other engine found. So it's basically understanding how these results talk to each other. And I'll give you an example. What if you run your SaaS scanner and you see that, I don't know, a credit card number is being written into an S3 bucket? Is this okay or not? I don't know. Maybe it's part of how I actually work. Maybe from this S3 bucket, it goes somewhere else and being being used for payment. Now let's put that aside and let's look at another tool of infrastructure as code. Let's say that we scan S3 buckets and I see that a specific S3 bucket is open to the public. Is that okay or not? I don't know. I have no idea. I have no context. Maybe it's your profile picture that goes out. But I see that you already know where I'm taking this. What if you have these two results? One telling you, look, your SAST found that you have credit card numbers go into that S3 bucket. Oh, by the way, your infrastructure as code scanner found that this bucket is open publicly. Is this a difference? Yes, it is. It's a huge difference. This is the difference that wake people at 2 a.m., et cetera. So for me, the platform is about that. It's not about the aggregation. It's not about that. It's about having a smart, let's call it discussion between the different engine, between the different scans, in order to be able to give you the right risk. And again, this brings us to risk, because eventually this is what will affect a developer or the decision of a company okay, I have a limited amount of time. Let's say I have a sprint to fix things. What am I going to do during that sprint? What are the most important things? Or I have now one day, or I have a critical. Is this something I need to do? And eventually, when you have the entire picture, you know, people say shift left, shift right, shift everywhere. For me, shift everywhere is the right way, but I look at it more as take a step back, actually. Shift back. Take a look at the entire thing, your entire solution from the get-go, from the source up until it goes into production. Have the context of what's happening there. And having a platform is basically giving you that context that many times is missing in products or scanners that are looking at very, very narrow scopes, no matter how good they are.
Yeah, I mean, I think you make some super valid points that are hard to argue with. Like some may argue for point products are best of breed, but we talked about the criticality of context throughout the conversation. And without having all those tools kind of bring together that insight and be able to see findings from one another and add context to what's actually important, it's going to be hard to make sense of what you need to prioritize. And then furthermore, as you point out, teams are struggling with cognitive overload. Everyone knows that cybersecurity teams typically are understaffed, under-resourced. You know, they might be struggling to kind of just keep up with the landscape. Having that consolidated platform that bring all that together, provide context, is an incredibly value-added activity, in my opinion. So I think you have a lot of valid points right there for the platform play. So I wanted to ask you as well, you know, you focus a lot, not only on the practitioner side of things, but you do a lot of work around research, you know, both on AppSec and software supply chain security at checkmarks. I'm curious, you know, from your perspective, from your team and so on, you know, how do you guys determine what to focus on from a research perspective, what to share with the community versus customers only? Like, how do you kind of navigate that decision and where to focus your attention to from a research perspective?
Okay. So, from the where we put our focus, that's not something I can easily define, but it's something we just do. I mean, I think that what I like about the research group that we kind of built here is that we are we're trying to adopt the attacker mindset, and this is kind of the perspective of an attacker when we're looking at technology. The first reaction is, what might go wrong, and how can I exploit it? So I think that this perspective, while still being connected to what's happening out there, exploits, breaches, and all the things we hear and see, this is kind of paves the way towards where we want to be, where we want to put our research. You ask what we share. So first of all, everything that is dangerous to the public, we share publicly as soon as possible. We're not holding back anything. We have a lot of cooperation with, you know, with GitHub and other repos, NPMs, PyPI. Every time we find something that should not be public, we report. And this is almost immediately, even before we start, you know, doing our own whatever PR, marketing, pushing it into the product, whatever. This is the first thing we do. This is our obligation. This is not negotiable. This is something that we must do. What our customers have, and you ask what goes publicly and what just our customers gain, is this time between when we report something and when it's actually removed. Unfortunately, it can be days, sometimes even weeks, which is still it still makes me dizzy to see sometimes a malicious package reported and still on for a month and actively being downloaded. So basically this is where our customers gain, but we never hold back. Also there are, you know, many times you report a package and then it's just the response is bloop, it's gone. You cannot research it. You cannot look at it anymore. So we hold that trail of evidence. We've actually been approached several times by security agencies asking for our help with looking at specific code snippets. So this is something we do and contribute. We do a lot of, you know, trying to increase awareness. This conversation is part of that, but We're going a lot. We're writing blogs, which you can find on our checkmarks.com under the blogs area. We have very, very interesting researches coming every now and then. And we're trying to share as much as we can. Most of our tools have some sort of open source version. Many of them start as open source. We love the community. And if it's not something that we want, you know, to have only for our paying customers, this is something that that we usually push towards open source. It works very, very well. The example is the infrastructure as code tool that is called Kix. It has the exact same abilities as an enterprise customer. And if you're just a standalone free user of that, the same with our secret solution. This is our contribution. This is what we feel we must do all the time. You know, going to conferences, sharing knowledge, you know, coining some abbreviations, infecting everyone with them, etc. So this is what we do.
Yeah, I'll say, you know, that's what caught my attention about Checkmarks is, you know, in a sea of, you know, we have a lot of security vendors. You all are very proactive about sharing knowledge, expertise, findings with the community, resources, whether it's tools or insights and so on. So definitely recommend checking out the blog for folks. I did want to ask, you know, before I let you go here in a couple of seconds, we did have a question come in about AI. So, of course, we got to touch on AI. The question was, how do we secure AI or CodePilot, you know, generated code and solutions? Any thoughts around that?
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, I touched a false sense of security in a different area. This is the same thing. So first of all, we need to understand that the same way we don't necessarily trust copy-pasted code from anywhere on the internet, Copilot is the same. So this is kind of the understanding of Copilot does not make your code more secure. It makes it quicker. By the way, there are some researches out there by, you know, academia and serious people, not clowns like me, that actually say that the level of security in the code, in auto-generated code and AI-generated code is lower. So just remember that. Just remembering that is probably one of the biggest things you can do for your code. The second thing is if you're using tools like Sast or anything that scans your code, most of them, at least the big tools, should be able to don't care where the code came from. Okay, so if Copilot wrote bad code, it should be flagged as if John Doe created that code. It shouldn't be a problem. I think that the biggest risk when we're talking about AI security is in the use of models. Currently, we need to start looking at different LLMs, AI models for different things as a black box. They are a black box. And the same problems we have with open source and not really knowing what's going on inside. Of course, you can check that, but not necessarily you do that. So take that times 1,000 because now you don't even see what's going inside. This is a real black box. This is completely obscure. And this is something we're going to need to address as a security, you know, ecosystem in general. And we're already starting to see different types of attacks. Again, I invite everyone to go to our blog and see some cool stuff we did, and we're working on more. Usually the next step is to work on securing those. And there are also, you know, some common issues of, you know, it's called hallucinations of ChatGPT, for example, when ChatGPT basically makes a mistake. It's nice hallucination, but basically it's a mistake and gives you some sort of library that is not necessarily you know, secure or even benign. So this is also some scanning plugins that we're working on to make sure that what you're getting, the information you're getting from ChatGPT, is relatively clean. But this is our biggest race at the moment, I think. The technology is way, way ahead of us.
Yeah, you raised a couple of good points, in my opinion. I think you're spot on. And we've had other folks from, you know, AI security experts on the show. And one is that you talk about the productivity gains of these AI generated code tools. But if this is insecure code, it's just going to expedite the development of insecure code at scale, which could mean more problems for us on the prioritization and remediation and incident response and so on side of things that we've talked about already. And then, as you point out, on the model side of it, it's kind of the anti approach of transparency, because in many cases, we don't know what data was used to train the models. And that's kind of the opposite of what we're pushing for with software transparency. So I think you're spot on in both regards in that front. So I want to ask, you know, aside from the blog, I talked about, you know, Checkmarks puts a lot of great resources, tools, and so on out there. You know, where can folks go to learn more, whether it's software supply chain security, AppSec, you know, aside from the blog, you know, industry events and so on, you know, where are some things people should keep an eye out for from both the research side and, you know, apps, Checkmarks in general?
Okay, so what we're doing is releasing all of our interesting research around the blog, the URL you show. In addition, I think that everything around application security is currently managed very well under the umbrella of OWASP. The people who are using OWASP as guidance, and I'm not talking only on the top tens and all that. There are some very, very nice checklists, white papers, do's and don'ts around specific things. It goes all the way from threat modeling in the beginning until incident response and playbooks for CISOs, etc. So I think this is a very good place to have some documented help. And also, you know, learning the dark side always help you to be prepared for a rainy day. I specifically love DEF CON and B-Sides. I think these are the two more hacker-oriented, you know, areas of learning some new things. OWASP also have some very nice days and meetups all over the world, and some two big global events also a year. And as I said, if I can with my shameless plugin, the AppSec Village that was in the past only part of DEF CON, is now also part of RSA. So if you're joining RSA, although it's a bit more suit and tie event, you still have the attacker perspective, the hands-on area of the sandbox at RSA, where there are several villages. One of them is the AppSec Village. And just open your mind. There are so many places, so many things to learn. I think it is really endless.
Yeah, well said. There's a lot of great resources, you know, not just the blog, but, you know, as you talked about RSA, B-Sides, DEF CON, AppSec Village. So folks, definitely check out that blog, get involved in these events, you know, see what adversaries are doing from an adversarial perspective and learn from that, like he just said there. That's it, Erez. Thanks so much for tuning into the show today and joining us. And thanks to everyone who listened in.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.